I don't know if this is exactly an infinite inning thing or not, but it's current events and it seems relevant. It's a very strange thing to me to walk around chanting, "We will not be replaced," because who's trying to replace you exactly? What overt plan is there for that? I sometimes worry about being replaced on an economic level because I have been replaced. When you get to a certain age and you get to have certain kinds of salary expectations, people can replace you because there's always somebody willing to do the job cheaper, and there's a bias in favor of people who are younger, and it's happened to me, and it's been happening throughout time. Nowadays, you can get sent off to pasture at 40, and you don't even get a gold watch. But in terms of being replaced as a breed, as a people, man, if anybody should think about that, it's people of my background, because from 1932 to 1945, someone actually tried it. It nearly worked, and it wasn't the first time. But I don't think about that in that sense very often, because I'm an American, and I live in the United States of America, and that is not the kind of place where we think of doing that to people. Yes, in the past, particularly when it came to Native Americans, we kind of tried it. We didn't try it in the organized way. It happened from 1932 to 1945. It was more protracted than that, but the effects were in their own way as bad. And for anyone who wants to dispute me on that, I direct you to look up the Sand Creek Massacre or Wounded Knee and understand that those were the big versions of something that there had been little versions of for years and years and years. That was the past, though. We seem to be doing less of that now. We've learned something. And even if we hadn't, it's the very people wandering about chanting, "We will not be replaced," who were doing the replacing then. As always, baseball offers us some instruction in this regard. The idea of being replaced was something that marginal white players had to confront when baseball finally began to integrate in 1947. Now, some of the guys at the time were just general purpose racists, and they objected to sharing facilities, sharing a team flight or a team bus with people of a different race, and they discriminated not because they felt threatened professionally, but because they had, as the Rodgers and Hammerstein song goes, been carefully taught to hate for hate's sake. When the Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson, Dixie Walker of Birmingham, Alabama, a star on the team, said, "I don't mind at all as long as he's playing for Montreal and not playing here." And he wasn't the only player, both with the Dodgers and in other organizations, who said the same thing. "Fine with me as long as it's not on my team." It's weird that somebody would go on record that way, but they did. But it wasn't Dixie Walker, a career 306 hitter, who was going to be threatened by that, who was going to be quote-unquote replaced. It was the guys who couldn't play, whose continuance in the major leagues depended on the fact that there was an artificial barrier that prevented the game from being a true meritocracy. In our game, a game that really symbolizes everything that America has always been about, the idea that all men are created equal, you play if you can play. You earn your playing time based on achievement. If you hit better than the other guy, if you run faster or throw harder, you get to be in the lineup. And this may be an imperfect analogy because, genetically speaking, some people have quick twitch reflexes and some people don't, and some people have great eyesight and some people don't. But everybody can do something. Everybody has some ability if they're willing to dig it out and find it. As always, I like how Casey Stengel put it. At one time in the 1950s, he was celebrating his team. And if you're not a Yankees fan, the homerism in this statement isn't going to be easy to hear. But try to put it aside and listen to what he was really saying. He said, "It's that carry-on spirit that the Yankees have. And everybody in this country wants somebody to be a Yankee or live like a Yankee, which don't mean just baseball, but to be somebody for the United States." And he was right. Stop bitching. Be somebody for the United States. The rest will take care of itself. Another person who I like in this regard, and who was intimately involved in the Jackie Robinson situation, was Pee Wee Reese. Pee Wee Reese was a shortstop, so initially was Jackie Robinson, so he was directly threatened. His livelihood, his place on the Brooklyn Dodgers, was directly threatened by Branch Rickey signing Jackie Robinson. When Robinson was signed, the wind down on World War II was in process, and Reese was still in the Navy. He was on a ship somewhere in the Pacific, near Guam of all places, when it came over the wires that the Dodgers had signed an African-American shortstop. And Reese had to think about that on a couple of levels, not just because he was the shortstop, but because he was from Louisville, Kentucky. He said, "The first thing I thought about when I heard about Jackie being signed was, why does it have to be a shortstop? Why does he have to be playing my position? Why does he have to be after my job?" And then he got even more anxious because there was a higher level to it. He said this in Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn. He was thinking, suppose he beats me out. I go back to Louisville. The people say, "Reese, you weren't man enough to protect your job from a..." And then he said an unfortunate word that I don't feel like repeating, but you can imagine what it was. He went on, "I mean, if they said to me, 'Reese, you got to go over and play in the Colored Guys League,' how would I feel? Scared? The only white? Lonely. But I'm a good shortstop. And that's why I'd want them to see. Not my color, just that I can play the game. And that's how I got to look at Robinson. If he's man enough to take my job, I'm not going to like it, but damn it, black or white, he deserves it." So you see, Pee Wee Reese came around to the right state of mind, the only rational state of mind, which is that no one is going to replace you except the better man, so it's time to get to work. And on a broader level, saying otherwise is paranoia, it's excuse making, it's special pleading. Once you find what you can do, once you are, as Casey put it, somebody for the United States, whether you're a ball player or a bricklayer, if you're good at it, you're essential. If you contribute, you're needed. All the complaining in the world, all the advocacy in favor of unearned privilege is not going to change that. You want to say that you're better than Ichiro Suzuki? Go make 4,000 hits. You want to say you're better than Joe DiMaggio? Go hit in 57 straight games. You want to say you're better than Hank Aaron? Go hit 800 home runs. And if you want to say you're better than the guy who's outperforming you in school, or making more money than you, or has bought your local business, well, get to work. Art Russ Jr., the sports radio talk show host and author, interviewed Emmett Ashford, the first African-American Major League umpire. And Ashford told a story about the heckling he got at one of his first jobs. A man in the stands called him that same racial epithet I didn't want to say before and said, "I don't want you out there trying to do a white man's job." Ashford remembered, "I looked up at him and said, 'If you go home and put on some shoes, maybe then we can discuss the matter.'" That about sums it up for me. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Shipping munitions on the Lusitania. To be fair, they didn't tell anybody. But what was really unfair was that they didn't tell you that your stateroom was right above the hold where they put all this stuff. So when the German torpedo hit and the whole thing blows sky high and you're shot 1,000 feet into the air, you have a wonderful view over it all. The flames, the smoke, the terror, the humanity of it all. And you think, if only I had taken that warning the Germans put in the paper seriously, I would have taken my voyage on episode 17. As you'll see, episode 17 not only goes to England and France, but to luxurious upstate New York. Lucky you. This week I'm joined by Jim Leake, the author of the new book, From the Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War, and you'll hear us discuss issues arising from America's entry into the war 100 years ago this year that are still relevant and complicated today, including: what do citizens owe the government in times of national emergency? Some ballplayers wanted to go fight and eagerly signed up. Others avoided it in some ways. And of course, some paid a very high price for going. Before we get to that, I wanted to tell you about some thoughts that Dr. Rick Mooring inadvertently put in my head. If you've listened to the show, you know Rick, or at least you know his name, because I mention him at the conclusion of every episode. He co-wrote the theme song with me, and he's also my oldest friend. That's why I have something to say about him each and every time. We have literally 40 years of anecdotes to play with in his case. And I just know he's dreading the day I come up with one that's going to be embarrassing to him. I feel like everything that's ever happened when we were together was embarrassing to me. But anyway, we were talking about something fairly inconsequential. There was a video online the other day, and normally I don't share these, but this was kind of special to watch. A woman drove her car off the 7th floor of a parking deck. And I observed to Rick that I'd always wondered just how effective those retaining wires that are in parking garages actually are. I figured they weren't really there to withstand a runaway car. They were just there to give you a false sense of security. And Rick clarified my point for me. He said, and I quote, "Anything not overly threatening in this world is there to give you a false sense of security." And it occurred to me that baseball is not overtly threatening. It's the opposite. It's reassuring. Except when Bud Selig is involved, it's reassuring because it's there almost every single day. Sometimes, though, that can give you the false sense of security that Rick alluded to. This is partially on my mind because of the subject matter of this week's episode, and partially on my mind because of the rash words and dark deeds that are being hinted at by various figures in public life. I won't be any more specific than that, but I thought I'd look up a few very particular days. Really bad days that didn't seem bad at the time. July 28th, 1914. That day, the Yankees played the White Sox in Chicago at Old Comiskey Park, and they lost 6-2. The Yankees manager was Frank Chance, the peerless leader, the Tinkers to Evers to Chance guy. He was on his way out. He had alienated Yankees ownership the year before by trading the star first baseman Hal Chase. He traded Chase because Chase was disrespectful and he was throwing games. That didn't bother the Yankees ownership at the time because Chase was their gate attraction and they weren't going to win anything anyway, but it bothered Chance. The shortstop that day was Roger Peckinpah. He was only 23 years old, but towards the end of that season, Chance got fed up finally with the Yankees ownership and he resigned. And they decided, for lack of anybody better, they'd make Peck the manager. I always liked the characterization in The Glory of Their Times by third baseman Jimmy Austin, who came up with the Yankees in 1909. Referring to all this nonsense, he said, "God, what a way to run a ball club." So basically, nothing's ever changed for the Yankees, and it was a very typical day in the life of that franchise. It was also, in addition to that, the day that the First World War broke out in Europe. Now let's skip forward a few years. On April 6, 1917, with opening day less than a week away, spring training was winding down. A dispute over Branch Rickey's services, he had been with the St. Louis Browns, and the St. Louis Cardinals, where he was hoping to go, had to be resolved in court. Rickey was allowed to become Cardinals president that night after stipulating he wasn't going to poach certain Browns prospects. Elsewhere, the A's star center fielder, Amos Strunk, great name, was sent home by manager Connie Mack from the team's barnstorming stop in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Mack, sounding very hurt, said, "You can just state that I am through with this player until he explains the cause of his actions towards me. I cannot understand why he acted so indifferently toward me by not speaking to me for the last 10 days. The Giants and Tigers played an exhibition at the Kansas State Agricultural College before a crowd of about 1,500, including many soldiers from Fort Riley. Jim Thorpe played for the Giants that day, and future Hall of Famers Wahoo Sam Crawford and Harry Heilman were in the outfield for the Tigers. Back in New York, the Yankees-Dodgers exhibition at Ebbets Field was rained out. In short, it was a very typical day in baseball for April. It was also the day that Woodrow Wilson asked the Congress to declare war on Germany, and they obliged. Now we're going to move forward even further in time. September 1st, 1939. Both Ben Chapman and Jeff Heath were in the lineup, one in center, one in left, for the Indians. Less than 8 years later, they'd both be kind of famous anti-integration guys, anti-Jackie Robinson guys, anti-Larry Doby guys. Heath hit a homer that day. In Brooklyn, Dixie Walker, another anti-Jackie guy, also hit a home run. In the game at Cleveland, Joe DiMaggio tripled off of Bob Feller, and I have nothing bad to say about that. But at Detroit that day, the 3-4-5 hitters for the Red Sox were Jimmy Fox. He went 2-for-5 with two doubles. Ted Williams, who went 3-for-3 with a double and two walks. And shortstop Joe Cronin, he went 0-for-4. And Cronin was another anti-integration guy. On the opposite side of the field, the Tigers were playing third baseman Pinky Higgins, who the Red Sox would later employ as a manager, general manager,
and designated asshole. He made it his personal mission to ensure that the Red Sox stayed lily-white as long as possible. And they were, in fact, the last team to break their color line. Grudgingly, reluctantly, half-heartedly. And if you want to find a reason for the long-lasting so-called Curse of the Bambino that was not broken until 2004, blame pure, self-defeating racism. Blame owner Tom Yawkey, blame player, manager, and general manager Joe Cronin, and blame Mike Pinky Higgins. He hit 2 home runs against the Red Sox that day. In other words, it was a typical day in baseball. Oh, and then in Philadelphia, the Boston Bees, or Braves, or whatever they were calling themselves back then, it was Bees, actually. They were trying to get away from their own bad reputation. They beat the Phillies. Boston right-hander Bill Posadell threw a complete game shutout. Posadell was known as Sailor Bill because he was a veteran of the U.S. Navy. That trips nicely off the tongue, Sailor Bill Posadell. He'd be back in the service before long. Because, you see, Hitler invaded Poland that day, starting World War II. Now, one more day. You know what's coming. This is not exactly it. December 6, 1941 was an off-season Saturday, so not a ton was going on. But the Yankees and the Athletics made a trade. Right-hander Johnny Bavich went from the A's to New York for a veteran minor league third baseman named Buddy Blair. It was an odd deal in that Bavich and the Yankees weren't on the best of terms. That season, he had threatened to bust up Joe DiMaggio's record hitting streak by refusing to pitch to him. That didn't happen, but the year before, he had more or less personally stopped the Yankees from winning a fifth straight pennant by going 5-1 with a 2.08 ERA against them. After he shut them out in September, Yankees manager Joe McCarthy was heard to moan, "Babich! Babich! Who the hell is Babich?" I very much doubt he said hell, but you get the idea. Now Babich was his. He knew who Babich was, which sounds odd, but from Carl Mays to Aroldis Chapman, the Yankees have never been particular about who did their work for them if they thought they might be useful. In short, it was just a typical off-season day, and the deal made that team executives could sit back and enjoy Sunday, December 7th, 1941. On all these days, the world was going to hell, and no one had the slightest idea. There's that version of this I like to think about sometimes. It's not baseball, it's Broadway. In late 1938, the playwright Maxwell Anderson and the composer Kurt Weill brought a show called Knickerbocker Holiday to Broadway. It was based on an old story by Washington Irving, the legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle guy, but oddly enough, they had turned it into an anti-fascist musical about Franklin Roosevelt. Anderson, who was kind of a far-left guy, thought Roosevelt was too cozy with the corporate types. Nothing ever changes. And for people on the political extremes, it doesn't matter if it's left or right. The perfect is always the enemy of the good. And Anderson didn't have the slightest idea of what was going on or what was about to befall the planet any more than the ball players and managers and executives that I mentioned on those other days did. Because the real fascists, not FDR, but the real fascists, were about a year away from burying the world in corpses. The only reason that anyone remembers that show is that Walter Huston, great actor, you can see him in a million movies, including The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which was directed by his son, John Huston. And of course, I should mention his granddaughter is Angelica Huston. He was given a song. It's a little warbly song because he didn't have much of a voice, so they intentionally kept the range of the song limited. It's this wistful little thing called September Song.
But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September, and I have lost one too, and I walk a little lame, and I haven't got time.
Sometimes there's something in the air. This is a seduction song, really, at least in situ. But when you yank it out of context and you think of the world into which it was born, it sounds like the song of a man who knows the world is about to come to an end, and he wants to get things squared away while he still has time. A great many people were about to die, so many that no one has ever been able to accurately count them all. 60 million might be right, but we have to give or take a million on that, and that's a painful thing for me to say, because every single one of them deserves to be counted on every side as a monument to our own arrogance, anger, stupidity, hatred, and, sure, courage and bravery. All of it began on an anodyne day. A day when the Yankees were playing the Indians. A day when you're taking in a baseball game or having a catch with your kid or working your job, mowing the lawn, walking the dog, anything really. making love to your guy or gal, and you were unaware that someone, somewhere, was courting danger. Those watching with you, the guy in the third row at the ballpark, the woman in the bleachers, the man or woman in your bed, the baby in your crib, the guy watching Joe DiMaggio hit that triple in Cleveland then, the fellow watching Mike Trout hit that triple right now. Maybe he was part of that 60 million, or maybe he'll be part of the next 60 million. We have to cherish the time, every moment, until then, because the day is coming. The only thing we don't know is when.
And the days dwindle down to a precious few. September, November. And these few precious days I'd spend with you. These precious days I'd spend with you.
I'll be back with Jim Leake in just a moment. I'm now pleased to be joined by Jim Leake, the author of From the Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War. It's out earlier this summer from University of Nebraska Press. How are you, Jim?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for dropping by. I really like baseball books that aren't just about pennant races or about a specific player achievement, like, say, a whole book about Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. I mean, those have their places, but I like things that get into the greater world and the way that the game interacts with it. Notwithstanding that we're living through the 100th anniversary of America's entry into the First World War, what interested you in telling this story about how baseball reacted to being in this environment?
Well, you know, I sort of stumbled across the story originally. I found a bound compilation of the Stars and Stripes newspaper published in Paris in World War I. It was the Army newspaper. And I was leafing through it and saw that they had a really good sports section. So that interested me. And I began blogging items lifted directly from the Stars and Stripes, and when I ran out of those, I went looking for more in American newspapers, and one thing led to another, and eventually led to this book.
The people who were writing for Stars and Stripes at that time, I guess this is well known to people who follow American literature of the period, but it wasn't just sports writers like Grantland Rice, but also guys who'd be more famous as members of the Algonquin Round Table, like Alexander Wolcott.
That's right. I mean, they essentially were the founders of the New Yorker magazines. It was an amazing staff.
So your book starts with war already having been declared. Baseball is still in the midst of something that echoed a controversy that had gripped the United States for the previous couple of years, which is the preparedness controversy. When the war started in 1914, Woodrow Wilson had told Americans very famously that we must be impartial in thought as well as in action. And then conversely, the Republicans didn't necessarily want to be pro-war, but they were definitely anti-Wilson. So they embraced this thing, preparedness, about scaling up the military and getting civilians involved in military activities. Theodore Roosevelt emphasized that. Leonard Wood, who was his old officer with the Rough Riders and had ascended to be chief of staff, was a major sponsor of this. How did baseball and baseball owners react to the idea of preparedness?
Well, you know, you're right. It was called the Plattsburgh Movement, and it was based at Plattsburgh, New York, upstate near the Canadian border. And there were a number of people in sports and in business and in finance and many fields who participated before America entered the war. And one of the big proponents, one of the big believers in the preparedness movement was T.L. Huston, the co-owner of the Yankees. And even before we were in the war, he was pushing for baseball to be prepared. By the time we were actually in it, Huston and Ben Johnson and others had arranged for every American League club to have a regular Army drill master who actually drilled the ball players on the field during spring training and on into the season. So it was sort of an amazing sight. As I say, every American League club and two of the National League clubs participated to some extent in this.
I was intrigued by the fact that the National League didn't really buy in. Charles Ebbets did, maybe one other owner did, but on the whole, it was an American League phenomenon. Why was that bifurcation extant?
You know, I think it was just that Huston and Johnson pushed it so hard in the American League, and there was no similar figure in the National League. That's not to say the National League was not patriotic. That's not the case. It was simply a difference of opinion, I think. And truthfully, not all of the American League clubs were that wild about the drilling, but they went along with it anyway, especially under pressure from Ben Johnson. He in fact threatened the Tigers to get in the line, or he would have something to say about it. So it was an interesting split. I don't think it necessarily reflected any sort of difference in patriotism. It was just different approaches.
Well, patriotism is an interesting term there, because as I alluded to before, as you alluded to in terms of the Plattsburgh movement, there was an interesting divide in the country in that the Plattsburgh movement was a legitimate thing. I think from our perspective, the thing to remember is that America didn't have a tradition of big standing armies. Between wars, the army was generally very small. The military overall was very small. Even after the First World War, we started scrapping Navy ships according to treaties. So the idea that we have this big military infrastructure is really something that dates more from the Cold War than from this period 100 years ago. So when you get into the preparedness idea, on one hand, you have people who are pushing it because they're pro-war or they believe we're going to be in the war eventually. And like you said, that's not just political. There's a patriotic aspect to that. There are some people who just believe in a bigger army, like Leonard Wood, the chief of staff. So on one hand, this was, again, something I think he believed in terms of having these elites in society go and train. But on the other hand, I think he was also minting people who would be supportive of an expanded army. And then on the other hand, there are people who believe, and this is their perspective on patriotism, either we shouldn't be in the war and that preparing for war leads to war. And then they also harked back to this tradition, which goes back to the debates on the Constitution, where people like James Madison said that, you know, standing militaries lead to titles and emoluments and things that destabilize a democracy. This is a little outside the corner of your book, maybe, but I'm curious in researching this, if you came across not just people like Till Huston, who was a big proponent of this, but either owners or ball players who were more on the pacifist side of this debate?
No, that's an interesting question. And in fact, I didn't. You know, the ball clubs were American businesses. And I can't imagine a club owner then or now having any sort of pacifism. You know, it just wasn't going to play. And whether they might have had those feelings privately, they didn't express them publicly.
That's a fair point. And I think one of the unfortunate things that we who do baseball research miss, and I don't know if this is just because colleges and universities weren't interested in purchasing, say, the Tris Speaker papers, you know, in the 1960s when that generation of players and the people who were involved in this period of American history were dying off. But we don't have the kind of first-person private reminiscences that we might have of some of the leading political players who left more of a record behind.
No, there isn't much record. My theory is that when people might naturally have begun writing up those sort of things, their memoirs or whatever, we were fighting World War II. There wasn't time or there wasn't the will for it at that point. So that World War I history just never got written. I mean, I was amazed. I looked for World War I baseball histories, and I couldn't find one. I'm not saying there's never been one written, but I looked, and I couldn't find one.
I mean, there were certainly many ballplayers who served in combat roles in World War II, a lot who also essentially played baseball for the duration, and many who did a little of both. But in the First World War, we did have ballplayers who served in major combat operations, who were in some of the most famous battles of the American part of the war, and even in the case of Eddie Grant, a very notable fatality.
Right. But we have to remember, too, that World War I for America was much shorter than World War II. For us, it lasted a year and a half, and we didn't really get into it until the spring of 1918. That is, we didn't have large numbers of troops in Europe. So the combat phase was relatively short. And I think that has something to do with the baseball histories from that era.
I think in general, the history of World War I was subsumed into World War II. And as you said, from our perspective, it was a smaller thing than in Europe, where if you were a French youth who was born between, 1890 and 1900 or something, you know, one out of three or some higher proportion of that, if you were male, those guys were dead. It was a huge chunk of a generation or two that got plowed under. And so we don't have to or didn't have to grapple with that level of tragedy. We experienced something closer to that to the Civil War, maybe, or in the Civil War, maybe, but not so much in the First World War.
Right. Americans didn't suffer nearly as much as the Europeans in the First World War. I mean, we had nearly, 4 million men in uniform. Only about half of them got overseas before the war ended, and that's pretty much dwarfed by the European armies.
It also leads to some things that seem really incongruous to us maybe now, given what we know about the war, given the level of violence and fatality to it that you and I were just discussing. You know, there's a famous shot of Franklin Roosevelt, who was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during that war, leading the Washington senators on the field. Maybe it was opening day, 1918. I'm not sure of the exact date. But the senators are behind him, marching in line, and they've got bats on their shoulders instead of rifles. And for those who don't know, FDR was still about 4 years away from contracting polio, so he was completely ambulatory. And he's leading them in march. And what's curious to me about this exercise and all of these exercises that Huston and Ben Johnson were sponsoring is that by then, a lot of the big battles of the war had happened. I mean, the Somme had happened, where the British suffered 57,000 casualties on the first day. And we're talking about from the majors to the minors, and you spent some time trying to figure out exactly how many ballplayers actually served all the way through organized baseball. We're talking about 1,000 guys out of an army of 3 or 4 million in the American aspect of it, and many millions more in the European aspect of it. And close order drill had nothing to do with the way this war was going to turn out. Was it almost consciously naive? Were they so gung-ho to participate that they were ignoring the fact that this was a really inconsequential thing to do?
I think it was symbolic. You're right, the numbers were so small that they were essentially meaningless in the grand scope of things. But the ballplayers were seen to be drilling. They were seen to be taking discipline. They were seen to be taking orders from Army sergeants. That all fed into the symbolism, to the wave of patriotism, to, in some ways, the preparation. I mean, it was clearly a recruiting tool as well.
And baseball didn't just do recruiting. Another thing that I really enjoyed learning in your book is the degree to which Clark Griffith really jumped into providing baseball materiel for soldiers all around the world.
That really is one of my favorite episodes. One of my favorite things that I learned while doing this book. Clark Griffith, in the spring of 1917, he saw soldiers guarding bridges and highways and railways and that type of thing in the South, and when they were coming north for the season. And he decided to raise some money to buy the troops some baseball equipment so they have some amusement and entertainment. And he started out small, but he was very crafty. He wrote to all the sports writers in the majors and asked them to contribute a quarter to his drive. And naturally, they printed his letter, and quarters began coming in, including a quarter from President Wilson. And the thing mushroomed on him. It soon became one of the most successful war charities of the war. And I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of baseball sets he gave away, but he equipped entire teams, both in the United States and overseas, for the Army primarily. The Navy had recreation funds of their own, and they didn't need much help from Griffin, but he did a great deal for the Doughboys.
I had to laugh at it a little bit, because for those who don't know, Griffith owned the Washington Senators. he started as a manager and eventually was able to purchase the team. And then his nephew, Calvin, owned the team for a very long time until he sold to the current ownership. He wasn't known for being Mr. Generosity. He's an employer of ball players, a guy who was usually in such low cash flow situations that he even sold his own son-in-law, Joe Cronin, the shortstop, to the Red Sox because Tom Yawkey made a high cash offer for him. So it was funny to me to read Griffith, who later in life would be known to be so tight with a buck, going out of his way to make this effort for the Soldiers.
None of the owners had much of a reputation for generosity because it was a tough, tough business. But the other person who comes off really well, I have to say, is Charlie Comiskey. He raised tens of thousands of dollars for the American Red Cross. He held a bat and ball fun days in his ballpark. He raised money all over the place. He really comes off very well.
I mean, that's the interesting thing, and this is true of all American lives or all great lives in general, or just lives in general, is that nobody's all one thing. And Clark Griffith was part of the segregated system of baseball. He made a lot of money renting out Griffith Stadium for Negro League games, and he did, I think it was maybe as late as World War II, make sort of a feint in the direction of integrating. He asked some of the Homestead Grays up to his office and talked to them about the possibility of playing for the Senators, but he never did follow up, and part of that was that his own cash flow was so implicated in keeping those games going. Comiskey obviously comes down as one of the villains of the Black Sox story, that he was underpaying his own players, so that helped put them in the way of temptation. At the same time, he was a guy who, as a player, was supportive of the first players union and left his own position in baseball to join with them because he felt solidarity for them. And then, as you said, in this instance, he was, again, supportive of the war effort and of Soldiers in general, so it just goes to show that no one's all one thing.
That's right. You read any sort of history at all, and you realize that all of it is complicated, and there really is no, or very little, black and white.
This leads us to the worker fight order that General Enoch Crowder issued in 1918, which said that all ball players had to either get into a defense industry, some kind of a factory job that helped the war effort, or they had to enlist. And this had the effect of shutting the game down, basically, in September of 1918. And it delineated really well some of the ambiguity about that, because the government just kind of kept saying amorphously, well, baseball has to shut down to do this, but they never quite said when. It was fascinating just how eager, and I confess I don't really understand this from our perspective, Ban Johnson and a couple of other owners, particularly the Cleveland Indians owner, just how ready they were to just shut it down. The other owners wanted to keep going as long as they could. Those guys were out of there, and I'm not clear what their motives were. Were you?
I'm not entirely clear either. Again, I imagine that it was complicated. The business of baseball is complex at any time. During wartime, it's more so. Maybe they simply would have cut their losses by closing early. Maybe they didn't like the uncertainty. Maybe they thought with so much unclear that the fans wouldn't come for whatever games were still played. The whole thing was somewhat mishandled and somewhat amorphous. And it wasn't just the ballplayers who were affected by the worker flight order. It was nearly all young American males, with some exceptions. So when it was first announced, it wasn't clear whether it applied to baseball. So then it was finally decided that, yes, it applied to baseball, but then it wasn't clear when it applied to baseball. So then they finally said, okay, it applies to baseball on Labor Day. Well, then could they play until Labor Day and then have an early World Series? Could they defer the series team ball players for those 10 days or 2 weeks? And finally they decided, okay, you can do that. But it was step by step by step and all the way along. So that might have fed into the eagerness to say, on some parts, to say, okay, let's just shut this down. This is just way too confusing.
Ban Johnson was the founder, or basically the founder and the president of the American League. And certainly, and this is something you point out, that as time went on, he became more autocratic and a little bit erratic in his speech and his decision-making. And after the war, when Judge Landis came in, his power was eroded, and then he made several additional missteps as well that basically split the league into pro-Johnson and anti-Johnson factions. That's later. But he made a major public relations error early in American involvement in talking about whether ballplayers should be involved or not.
Right, he did. After the 17th season, so much was uncertain that Johnson was talking with some sports writers in his office in Chicago. And there are varying accounts of exactly what he said and what he meant and what they quoted. But the gist of it was that he was quoted as saying, if each major league team could exempt 18 players, they could get through the next season. He was probably just speculating and spitballing, and maybe it was off the record. I don't know, but he was quoted, and everything blew up. I mean, you can imagine. You can't in wartime say, I need to exempt 18 ballplayers on each club from military service. That just did not go over. He just got hammered from all sides. He had his defenders, including Connie Mack, saying, you know, he was misquoted or misunderstood. He was just speculating. But by that time, it was too late, and Johnson just got killed.
You're right that you can't say that, at least that way. But there's a contrast between the worker fight order, if I understand it correctly, the worker fight order did exempt certain classes of entertainers. And if you look at World War II, where in contrast to Newton Baker, the Secretary of War, shutting down baseball completely, and Franklin Roosevelt writes the famous green light letter to Commissioner Landis saying, of course, we've got to take all the prime guys, but if you can scrape together enough guys to keep baseball going, then I'd like that because this would be a value to society in terms of, well, we're going to have a lot of people here still at home working in the war effort, and they need a break. They need to go to baseball games or go to movies or have some relaxation. Even in a total war, there is a necessity to blow off a little steam. Johnson was roundly condemned for this, even though you could have looked at it the way that Roosevelt did. What had changed between the two world wars that this was open to such condemnation in 1917 and 1918, and less so in 1942?
In World War II, you had old ball players and young ball players. You didn't have the young, healthy ball players still playing ball.
Right.
And that seemed to be what Johnson was saying in World War I. And as more and more ball players got drafted into the service, that's what happened. You know, the clubs pulled in, you know, has-beens and never-wears and married men with exemptions and that type of thing. More and more, that's who staffed the ball clubs. So there are some parallels between the First and Second World Wars.
It's interesting, though, that we're kind of willing to accept that, yeah, we don't want society to come to a complete halt, even though the country is in this very dire, obviously, emergency situation and needing to fight and win, whether in 1918 or in 1942, the biggest wars that the world has ever seen. But at the same time, we want things to roll on. Even in a totalitarian society like Nazi Germany, they still had movies and concerts and things right until the very end when society fell apart. And yet, on the other hand, there's a perception of fairness where we're willing to condemn unequal treatment for people. And so even in World War II, you eventually had a comb out where some of these guys who had been playing ball in the service the whole time were actually told, look, you have to go fight. And so it's hard to kind of understand the way that we manage to maintain both mindsets at once.
I know. As I said, it's always complicated and there's rarely any clear-cut answers. And personally, I don't have much of objections to professional ballplayers or athletes doing the same thing in the military. I mean, okay, Joe DiMaggio played baseball in World War II. Fine. You know, there were probably millions of GIs who wanted to see him play baseball, even if he was in the Army Air Forces, you know. That's fine. That's a morale builder. I've never entirely understood, or I certainly haven't entirely agreed with that mindset or opinion.
You're a veteran yourself. When you come at this, I assume that does influence your take on controversies like these.
It absolutely does, yes. Anybody who's been in the service comes back a little different and thinks differently. That's just the way it is. If I hadn't been in the Navy, would I think that? I don't know. I doubt it. You know, there are all sorts of roles in the military. There are frontline combat roles. And, you know, there's a case to be made that athletes should be in those roles. But I think there's an equal case that they perform a valuable service if they happen to play ball, you know, once or twice a week and entertain some people and help raise funds. And that's fine with me. I've never had a problem with that.
As with any bureaucratic entity, not every soldier carries a gun. You know, in World War II, they talked about the man behind the gun. Those were the civilians. But in reality, even in the actual service, there are a lot of guys who wield word processors or at that time typewriters rather than stand at the front lines and are in combat, because for every regiment, every battalion, you have headquarters staff, you have people who are in supply, you have... So really, as you say, what at that point, if you have basically every aspect of society supporting the soldiers at the front, why not have entertainers also?
That's right. You know, for combat troops, they use the term tip of the sword. Well, that's the tip. There's a whole long spear behind it, you know. it's a big and complex organization, any Army or Navy or a Marine Corps. You know, you're going to have lots of troops all the way from the front lines all the way back to America. You know, that's just the way it is.
So another thing that I found really surprising, this was something I knew about, but I didn't know that it was as extensive as the way you described it, was the factory leagues, the industrial leagues that were very popular in America. And this was the really shocking part, the degree to which once the government weighed in, they were competing with major league teams, for players.
They were. The United States needed hundreds, thousands of ships built to fight the war and get the men over there. They needed materiel of war. They needed planes. They needed tanks. They needed vehicles. They needed everything. Somebody has to build that stuff. So a lot of the industrial jobs were exempted from the draft. A lot of the big industrial companies like Bethlehem Steel and others, they had huge, huge operations, and they naturally had sports teams, and they had very good baseball teams. To some extent, they did raid the major league rosters. When the draft really began to bite, some ballplayers, frankly, jumped their teams and went to work for the industrial leagues, like the Bethlehem Steel League, which was called STAL League in some quarters because they nabbed so many ballplayers from the major and minor leagues. But, you know, it wasn't illegal. These ballplayers were performing their jobs, presumably, during the week and playing ball on for the company teams on weekends. Afterwards, later in the war, there were a lot of married family ballplayers who weren't taken right away, who were in Class 4 of the draft. They went to these industrial leagues as well, and there was a pretty good brand of ball played there, naturally. The biggest name, really, was Joe Jackson, who jumped early. He got a draft notice, and he said, okay, well, I guess I'll be over there. And the very next day, he started as a painter at a shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware. Well, he became a lightning rod. The wrath of the American sporting public came down on Joe Jackson's head. You know, he was a slacker, he was a draft dodger, he was this and that, and those names were applied to a lot of other ballplayers as well. In many cases, completely unfairly. But Joe Jackson too, you know, he did his job. He was working in a shipyard that whole time. And after the war, a lot of the high feelings dissipated, really. The Sporting News was one publication that really came down on ballplayers playing baseball in the services and really, really came down hard on the shipyard ballplayers. And it was very interesting. I found a clip as the 1919 season was about to begin where somebody on Sporting News wrote a column saying, well, you know, a lot of us have since been in the military ourselves, and maybe we were too harsh. So if you went to the shipyards and you did your job and you helped build the ships for the war, all right, you know, essentially they were saying, all is forgiven. We understand now. And the ballplayers that came back, surprisingly, didn't suffer much grief at all.
They must have understood, even during the war, as you said, that this need for materiel was pressing and that the country was shifting over to a war economy and everything was going to be geared for sending war material overseas. So that was a legitimate thing, and you wouldn't criticize the average person for going to work in a war factory. You might congratulate them for doing that, particularly if they had a family to support and it wasn't practical for them to be out there with Pershing. But I guess there was suspicion that people like Jackson, their motives weren't pure?
I think you hit on it with the word average. You wouldn't criticize the average person for taking a legitimate job in a shipyard. But ballplayers were sports stars. You know, they were supposedly role models. whether that's fair or not, you know, that's for everybody to answer individually, I think. I don't think it's fair. In writing this book, I tried to view the ballplayers as ordinary young men who happened to be very good at one thing, and that was baseball. They had the same pressures, they had the same responsibilities of it as every other young man in the country. And they all had to decide very basic questions for themselves. All right, so maybe the sporting public didn't agree with some of those decisions. Maybe you could even criticize them. But you have to be in that man's shoes. You have to know his circumstances. You can't just blindly across the board criticize people for working in a shipyard or taking a deferment or whatever. You have to know the individual case. That's my feel anyway.
And of course, this resonates right through history, where even Mickey Mantle in the 50s was getting grief for being deferred because of his osteomyelitis.
Right. It's always been a tricky issue, and the money today even makes it even trickier, you know. Of course, there's no draft today. Nobody is obliged to go into military service now, and there are very, very few professional athletes of any stripe who've been in the service, which is why the Pat Tillman story is so gripping and so tragic.
One player who seems to have escaped the opprobrium that greeted Joe Jackson, and yet it's not quite clear that he exactly did anything in the war, is Babe Ruth. And he was already a star. He was just beginning to make the transition from pitching to playing in the outfield, at least part-time while still pitching. And, you know, I learned something, because there's a famous picture of Ruth in uniform shaking hands with Pershing. And yeah. I always assumed that that dated from the war, but it doesn't. It's a publicity shot from much later. Ruth really didn't do anything during the war, did he?
No. At one point, people thought he was going to jump to one of the shipyard teams himself, because he got mad at the club and left for a few days. But he came back having never played in the shipyards. And when the season ended in 1918, Ruth had like half a dozen offers to go to work for the shipyards or industrial concerns, and he accepted one from Bethlehem. And I think he played in a very few games on company teams. And then, like a lot of other people, he was struck down by the flu, which was very deadly back then. So,
No,
he was never very much criticized at the time, and certainly not since. And you're right about that picture. That picture was taken in 1924, when the New York National Guard was having a recruiting drive, and Ruth signed up. And, of course, he had to report personally to General Pershing in Washington. That's the famous picture, but it's not from the war.
He was never drafted? I don't think he had many dependents at that point. He was married, but I don't even know if he had his first daughter at that point.
I think he did, but I can't swear to it. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know why others were drafted and he wasn't, but he was able to get into the shipyard leagues, the steel mill leagues, rather.
On the opposite side of the spectrum from Ruth, today's fans who might casually look at the Hall of Fame voting record over the years might not understand why Braves catcher Hank Gowdy got votes in 17 different Hall of Fame elections and got as much as 36% of the vote at one point. It wasn't for his on-field play, was it?
Not entirely, no. Hank Gowdy was a catcher for the Boston Braves. He was the star of the Miracle Braves 1914 World Series. He was a very good and very popular player, but he was also the first active major leaguer to enlist in the Army during World War I, and he enlisted early. He enlisted, I think, was the first week of June and was in uniform the next month. He comes from my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, and he, a road series in Cincinnati, took the train up to Columbus, enlisted in the Guard, and went back. His guard unit ended up as part of the 42nd Division, the famous Rainbow Division. That was Ohio's unit in that division. And he was overseas early, and he was in combat early, and he was there until the end. So all along, the Gowdy story played very well and got a lot of ink. He said and did all of the right things. And he came home baseball's biggest military star. It's hard to appreciate now how famous he was at the time.
The one thing that I admire about him even more than that he led the way for major league ball players and really did set an example for the country in some ways. And I want to point out that was a useful thing, because even though war had been declared, and we like to think that whenever the government calls in an emergency that people go running to their recruitment stations, they don't wait for their draft orders. Just a few years earlier, the government or the Army, under the same General Pershing, he wasn't a general yet, but they put out a call for volunteers to fight along the Mexican border. And the Army never met its recruitment efforts in that. So that a Hank Gowdy would jump out and set an example is actually a valuable thing.
Hank Gowdy was the role model that the American public thought all ballplayers should be. Again, it's not that simple, but he was a very admirable person, and he deserved all the good press he got.
And one of the other great things about him, and this is almost more moving to me in a way, is that when World War II hit, even though he was, 55, pushing 60, he went back.
He went back. He became a major in the Army. He was an athletic officer, and he served down at Fort Benning, Georgia. And what's really interesting is that the ball field down there then and now was Hank Gowdy Field, and had been Hank Gowdy Field since sometime in the 1920s. So he was coaching ball players in the Army on a field named for him 20 years before. It's an amazing story.
Was he somewhat embarrassed by that?
He was a fairly modest guy. He said at one point that it should have been named Eddie Grant Field. I think he sincerely believed that.
Hank Gowdy is one ball player remembered for his service during the First World War. We'll talk about one who made the ultimate sacrifice right after this word from our sponsors.
We should mention real fast Eddie Grant, who was a former Giants infielder, not a star by any means. He was an attorney. I believe he was Ivy League educated. And
he was. They called him Harvard Eddie.
Harvard Eddie. He was
in the outfield. He used to say, "I have it," rather than "I've got it," because it was more grammatically correct.
like his fellow Harvard man Theodore Roosevelt, who when he was a Badlands cowboy, instead of saying "Hurry up" or "Get along," he would say "Hasten forward quickly there." So very very, and they did. The other cowboys made fun of him. But he was part of the Plattsburgh movement. He went to the Plattsburgh camps and unfortunately died in the Argonne Forest.
He did. He
yes.
did. He at the time, because so many of the men in his regiment had been wounded, he was leading a battalion, and he was trying to rescue the Lost Battalion, the famous Lost Battalion, whose commander was a friend of his and another New York attorney, and he was killed by shell fire and buried there.
The Lost Battalion is somewhat of a misnomer, because they were never lost. They knew where they were, and the Army...
Nobody could get to them.
Yeah, exactly. They were lost in the sense that they'd been written off, not in the sense that they were misplaced. They were surrounded, and so there was this effort to get to them, and Eddie Grant, very heroically leading the effort to go to their relief, went without sleep, went without food, and just was struck down out of nowhere by a shell.
Right. They say Eddie Grant was so exhausted he could hardly lift a cup to his lips, and others in the unit had urged him to go back to an aid station and rest a while, and he wouldn't do it. And they heard the shell fire coming in, and he told people to drop, but he didn't get down himself, and he was killed by a shell fragment.
One of the things about that bothers me, but it's just typical, and we've touched on this before, is the way that the memory of the war gets subsumed, so that when you read that one of the features in the outfield at the Polo Grounds was an Eddie Grant memorial, it's not very long later that people are saying, "Who is Eddie Grant?" And it really strikes me as unjust. Maybe you know more about this than I do, but when the Polo Grounds were torn down after the Mets left, that monument disappeared, and I don't know if it's ever turned up since.
Well, it supposedly turned up once, but apparently it's not the real deal. I believe the real Eddie Grant monument is still missing, though there's a replica of it at AT&T Field at the Giants Park out in San Francisco.
That's a wonderful thing that they still remember. Not every major leaguer who served was, fortunately, a fatality, but some of them did or were the worse for it. And there are two pitchers we should probably talk about. One is Christy Mathewson, and the other is Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Right. A friend of mine who's written about them for Sabre says that World War One, you know, damaged both the two greatest American pitchers. Christy Mathewson was in the Chemical Warfare Service in what they call the Gas and Flame Division. And when he was in France, he and Ty Cobb, who was in the same unit, were in a training accident. They were training troops about poison gas. And unbelievably, they used real poison gas. And everybody missed the signal to put on their gas mask, and the gas was released, and the troops were exposed to it. And there was a mad scramble to get out of whatever compartment they were in. And 8 soldiers died, and Cobb and Christy Mathewson were both exposed to it. Cobb felt the effects for several weeks, but had no lasting effects. Christy Mathewson got a worse dose of it, and it bothered him the rest of his life and probably contributed to his early death from TB. And the other pitcher you mentioned, Old Pete, Grover Cleveland Alexander, he was drafted into the Army and was put in the 342nd Field Artillery, which had, it was interesting, that unit had 5 major league ball players and a future major leaguer, a bunch of minor leaguers and some collegiate players. They had an amazing ball club. But unlike a lot of service clubs, which stayed together at least most of the time, this whole unit went overseas, and they didn't play much ball in France, and they were in action. They were in combat for 7 weeks. Cleveland, he wasn't overtly wounded, but he came back changed. He came back with some hearing loss. He possibly came back with what we would now call PTSD. He may have suffered somewhat physically from pulling the lanyard on one of the big guns. He was never quite the pitcher he was before, after the war. He was still a great pitcher, but it took him a while to get back to being a good pitcher, and he was never quite the same athlete or never quite the same man after the war. So I'd say Jan Finkel, my Sabre friend and acquaintance, says that war ruined these two great pitchers.
Alcoholism was so rampant in the major leagues at that time, and going back to the 19th century and going forward many decades after that, it's always hard to guess the cause and effect when somebody in baseball has such trouble with alcohol as Alexander did. So I don't know if he was a drinking man before his war experience, but it certainly, at the very least, exacerbated the problem.
I think that's probably true. I don't know how much he drank at that point, or even if he did drink the excess at that time. But 7 weeks in combat, and what another friend of mine calls the 47 days, the crucial big push that finally broke the Germans, that's going to affect anybody.
And I mean, if you're in an artillery unit, that you're not in the trenches at the very front, but you are subject to counter-battery fire as the other side tries to knock you out before you can knock them out.
That's right, and I've read the unit history, and they came under fire, and they came under gas attack. You know, they weren't up running, dashing into the machine gun fire, but they were definitely in combat, and they were firing literally to the last minute or seconds of the war, you know, right up to 11 o'clock on November 11th.
And one thing that people probably don't understand about the First World War that is so frightening to contemplate is that even to this very day, there are so many people listed as MIA in that war, and it's not that they wandered off or that they died under some tree somewhere and were never found. It was that the shelling, the firepower was so intense that for so many people, there was literally nothing left to find.
They were either just obliterated off the face of the earth, or they were buried in shell holes or bunkers or dugouts or whatever. You know, in France and Belgium, they're still routinely finding the remains, the skeletal remains of World War One soldiers. And they're still finding live ammunition buried in the earth.
There were sappers digging under the lines and planting explosives down there that are probably still lurking and very unstable to this day. And periodically you'll read about some French farmer plowing his field who pops one of these things, and it would be funny if it wasn't so frightening.
I know. I mean, there are still demolition disposal experts who are working the French and Belgian fields. You know, that stuff still turns up.
It really is. I mean, every war is horrifying, and there's no war and people thought in this war that this was kind of going to be a fun thing at the outset, and everybody cheered it. And this was one of the events in human history that really changes the perception of war from, you know, this is a manly character building exercise to something that maybe we should avoid in the future. But you read about, say, somebody who cheered the war on, like Rudyard Kipling, who pulled strings so his own son, who was practically blind, can get in. And then he ended up spending the rest of his life looking for his son's body because he was killed and just, again, was probably obliterated and was never found. And so people had a chance, whether it was Pete Alexander who served and came under fire, or even people who were for the war and sent loved ones, had a chance to repent at leisure.
Right. It's never what anybody imagines or what anybody tells you going in. Never. It's always a sad and terrible business, no matter how many flags you wave, no matter how many troops walk by or march by under stirring music. You know, it's not a pretty thing.
I want to get back to that point, but before we wrap up, I do want to mention and ask you about your involvement in the Anglo-American Baseball Project and what that is and what the goal is.
The goal all along has been to recreate a World War I baseball game that was played in England, in London, on the 4th of July, 1918. It was a U.S. Army Navy game from a league that played there, and the King and Queen Mother and tens of thousands of Londoners and Allied troops saw the game. So we'd like to duplicate that game next year in London. It's a very complicated thing. It's not clear yet whether we'll actually manage it in England or maybe in the United States. To some extent, that depends on what MLB decides to do next year themselves in London, because they did a very successful event this 4th of July in Hyde Park. So we're talking with various people in various places, and we'll see what results.
I love the stuff that comes down to us from those interactions between baseball and England at that time, whether it's pictures. You have one in the book of the King shaking hands with the ball players, or later there was a Giants tour that went out about, I think, 1923 or 1924. There's a wonderful picture of Casey Stengel, of all people, shaking hands with King George V, and King George is bowing slightly towards Casey, and Casey is slightly bowing towards him, and everybody seems very amused. And there's also a line that I've thought about for many years, and I'm not totally sure what he meant about this, that when George Bernard Shaw went to one of these games and met John McGraw, and he said, "I've at last met the real, authentic American." And I don't think he meant it positively, but I'm not sure.
Well, the British had a very mixed reaction to American baseball. They were thrilled to see the enthusiasm and the athleticism of the military ball players, because they weren't quite sure of us as allies. But, you know, to their way of thinking, we were late getting into the war, and it took us a long time to get the troops over there. So when they saw that 4th of July game and the wild enthusiasm, the tremendous game, they actually saw a great game, they were very heartened. But they were sort of amazed and or appalled by the catcalls, by the kill the umpire, by the chants back and forth. You know, the American military rooters were pretty exuberant, and the British people really didn't know what to make of that. One American had to assure an elderly British lady that no, they really weren't planning to kill the umpire.
Along those lines, you had a quote in the book from Mathewson once he came back, once he got over the gassing, and he said, "I think the only people who need to be gassed are the umpires." And I thought, wow, that really wouldn't fly today.
No, it wouldn't fly today. And I was surprised to hear it from Maddie, too. You know, he didn't usually say that kind of thing, but I assume he was joking.
I certainly hope so. So as we close here, I want to ask one last question. And you just said something very, very wise about war, which is that it never is what we think it is. And again, I think people have gone into subsequent wars with eyes more wide open than they did in the First World War, where they really thought it was going to be over quickly. And it began with something where a larger power, Austria-Hungary, thought that it was going to avenge this terrorist action that may or may not have been sponsored by the Serbian government, which was the assassination of the heir to the throne. Everybody, I guess most people know this. But this was supposed to be kind of a small thing that almost viral style spread to the rest of the continent and eventually took in a good chunk of the world, including us. And, you know, I got into I want to be clear, I'm not opening a larger political discussion here, but I'm just going to say this to explain the context of what it is that I'm asking you. I got into a discussion on Twitter the other day with somebody who was, and Twitter is not a good environment to do this, but was very favorable to some kind of military intervention with North Korea, and seemed to have the sense that we would just kind of run up and punch them in the nose and run away and there'd be no further consequences. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But it seems to me that there are also various ways that that kind of interaction can have unforeseen consequences and expand in just as the First World War expanded. And so what I want to ask you, having read this book, is what lessons can we draw from the experience of baseball in the First World War and the way that a big commitment like that, a general war, can transform the American experience of the game and, for that matter, of daily life on the, as a whole?
Well, you know, there's an old saying that the your war plan lasts until the first shot is fired.
Right.
You don't know what's going to happen. Nobody's going to know what's going to happen. You can plan all you want. You get into it, and something else is going to happen. That's just the way it is. Baseball and the rest of America could plan whatever they liked. In April 1917, the war had a way of rearranging those plans, whatever they were, for whomever they were. And as I said earlier, the ball players, except for their one amazing talent, were just average American young males. They had all the same decisions to make, all the same responsibilities, all the same duties, all the same choices. You know, they made them individually, one by one. As a group, I don't think they were any more admirable or any less admirable than young Americans as a whole at the time, men and women. You get into it, you make your own choices, and support the country as best you can, whatever way you think that is. And I think that's what these ballplayers did.
I think that's the best that we all can do. Whether agree or disagree, you support the country and hope for the best.
Right.
Jim, I really enjoyed From the Dugout to the Trenches, and I want to thank you for taking the time to stop by and talk about it with me.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, and thanks for having me.
By Joyce Kilmer, Alan Seeger, Rupert Brooke, and Wilfred Owen, we've made it to the end of another episode. You can follow Jim Leake on Twitter at WW1Baseball. That makes sense. And as always, you can follow me at GoStephenGoldman. Why go Stephen Goldman? Because it's either that or go to the bookstore and buy all these books yourself. I'm also always eager to hear from you at infiniteinning@gmail.com. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, we're still brought to you by a number, and that number is Big Six. I thought our producer had a degree in this stuff, but he told me he's self-taught, learned it all from listening to old Eagles records. Eagles records! Can you imagine? Our theme song, The Infinite Man, which you are listening to now and have been listening to throughout the episode, was co-written by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Many years ago, an emotionally disturbed young woman quite literally teed off on him, striking him across the legs with a golf club. He's such a nice guy that, even though he was in excruciating pain, he made out like it was his fault. Me? I'd have been threatening to sue or crying. Well, so long as I remind my chauffeur not to make a K-turn on any crowded streets in Sarajevo, I'll be back next week, and I'll have more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.